Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why have human rights campaigns failed in China? What activism can work in the authoritarian country? But first, in commemoration of the 103rd anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, we revisit two important conversations. With Pulitzer Prize-winning author, poet, and professor Peter Balakian, and then with professor and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ben Bagdikian, an Armenian Genocide survivor who was later responsible for publishing the Pentagon Papers while working at the Washington Post. Ben Bagdikian's character was portrayed by Bob Odenkirk in the Oscar-nominated film The Post. Bagdikian passed away in 2016. We are joined by Peter Balakian. He's professor of humanities at Colgate University, award-winning writer and poet, and the author of at least two best-selling books, The Black Dog of Fate, his memoir. It won the Penn Martha Albrand Prize for memoir and a New York Times notable book. And he also wrote The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. Welcome to the show, Peter Balakian.
Thank you.
So in your book, The Burning Tigris, you describe living conditions for Armenians in the Ottoman Empire and other non-Muslim factions in the late 1800s prior to the genocide. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, to be Armenian in this case, or to be non-Muslim in the Ottoman Empire, meant that you were legally designated with infidel status. You were thought of as a non-believer, and the colloquial term was gavur, which was sort of a slang, a derogatory slang. Now, infidel status meant that you were relegated to a separate and not equal social, political, and economic status. Christians, for example, Armenians, for example, couldn't join the military. They couldn't join the civil service. They were taxed in a much more severe way, and in a way that really fleeced much of the agrarian community. They weren't allowed to own weapons. They weren't allowed to ride horses in urban areas. And they had no legal rights in Islamic courts of law. This was another way in which property was extorted by Muslim overlords. Women were abducted, disappeared into harems and into slavery and so forth. So living with infidel status was very difficult.
Yeah, you quoted an ethnographer who said what it was like to be Armenian. He said they were dogs and pigs to be spat upon, if their shadow darkened a Turk, to be the mats on which he wiped the mud from his feet.
Yes, that was Mr. Ramsey, the British anthropologist and journalist who spent a lot of time in the Ottoman Empire in the latter part of the 19th century. It was often very difficult. And so Armenians in the latter part of the 19th century began to ask for some change, and that began to lead to trouble.
Can you get into some of that trouble?
I think it's important to understand the massacres of the Armenians in the 1890s that were conducted by Sultan Abdul Hamid II, and then the genocide of the Armenians that was implemented by the Young Turk government as the result of what I would call a civil rights movement. Christian Armenians asking for reform and change, organizing political parties, protesting peacefully in the streets, demonstrating, petitioning, and asking the question, in my opinion, they asked the fundamental question, can a Christian be the equal of a Muslim in the Ottoman Empire? And the answer was meted out very decidedly no, and then the no was expressed in wholesale violence and massacre. Interestingly enough, the first real conflict, I would say, or at least the first dramatic conflict between reform-oriented Armenians and their Turkish and Kurdish overlords was over taxes, where Armenians stood up and refused to pay the fifth round of fleecing of the taxes in that spring season in 1894. And when they were fired on, they stood up. They didn't go away. They fired back. And that led to a wholesale massacre of what would end up as some 200,000 innocent civilians being massacred by the Sultan in the 1890s. The plan to exterminate the entire Armenian population, about 2.5 million Armenians living on their historic homeland of some 2,500 years, so that's important to understand. The plan to exterminate the Armenians was hatched by the Young Turk government, or better known as its political party, Committee of Union and Progress, that had taken power in Turkey in 1913, and the government was run by Minister of the Interior, Talat Pasha, Minister of War, Enver Pasha, Minister of the Marine, Jamal Pasha. And the Minister of the Interior, Talat, was the mastermind, along with his high-ranking CUP officials, in a project to use the moment of World War I as a screen behind which to exterminate the Armenian population. And this was very well planned and organized, and I think that's important to understand, because the Turkish government today, in denying the Armenian genocide, would like the world to think that this was not organized. Well, this was one of the most efficiently organized genocides in history. It was carried out by a special bureau of the Committee of Union and Progress called the Special Organization, the SO. And the SO, under the leadership of Talat and one of his high-ranking bureaucrats, a physician named Dr. Benahin Shakir, the SO established mobile killing squads to do massacring all over what is today Turkey, all over Anatolia and Asia Minor. And how were those killing squads created? They were created by the releasing of some 30,000 convicts from prison. Now, this takes a lot of planning and organization. I think it's important to note that emergency executive legislation was used. A temporary law of deportation was passed in May of 1915, and something called the temporary law of confiscation and expropriation was passed in September of 1915. And these parliamentary acts, temporary as they were, legitimized and expedited the government's ability to arrest every Armenian man, woman, and child throughout Turkey and place them on deportation, as they were called. But deportation meant massacre. It meant, really, death march. Technology was used. Armenians were put into boxcars in the western part of Turkey. Cattle cars made for a dozen animals were stuffed with 80, 90, 100 men, women, and children. We think of that as only belonging to the Holocaust, but it really started with the Young Turk government in 1915. So these were some of the methods of organization. And so it's also, again, important to note that there was a very systematic approach to the Armenian population, so that the intellectual elite were wiped out often first: professors, writers, poets, journalists, playwrights, community leaders were killed, were rounded up. And this, of course, is the event that Armenians worldwide use to commemorate the beginning of the Armenian genocide on April 24, because it was on that night in 1915 that about 250 intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople were first arrested and sent on trains to the interior, where most of them were tortured and killed. And the idea here is, of course, that you cut the head off of the culture, you pull its tongue out. And again, it allows us to see the systematic plan in motion.
Now, you also gave this genocide a particularly important role in both world history and American history. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I think it's important to understand the groundbreaking nature of the Armenian genocide. First, it really began the age of genocide, modern genocide. Genocide exists as far back as recorded history. We can find episodes and examples of race extermination. But modern genocide suggests the use of technology and state bureaucracy implemented for the purpose of liquidating an ethnic or culture group of people in a concentrated period of time. And the first time that was done was in 1915 by the Ottoman Turkish government against the Armenians. So that the Armenian genocide inaugurates modernity, the darkest side and chapter of modernity. The genocides that follow it all owe something to it. Adolf Hitler said 8 days before invading Poland in 1939, who today, after all, speaks of the annihilation of the Armenians. And Hitler, of course, was inspired by the fact that the Young Turk government had done what it had done to the Armenians. Secondly, the Armenian genocide is crucial to understanding World War I, just the way the Holocaust is crucial to understanding World War II. It was former President Theodore Roosevelt who said that the Armenian massacre was the greatest crime of the war. Thirdly, I think it's important to note that the Armenian genocide really played an interesting, important role in the evolution of modern human rights and international law. And Raphael Lemkin, the man who coined the term genocide, did so in part on the basis of what happened to the Armenians in 1915, as well as what was happening to the Jews of Europe before his very eyes. So that the Armenian event is, shall we say, etymologically part of the evolution of the term genocide. And then, yes, you mentioned my point in The Burning Tigris that the Armenian genocide plays an important role in American history. It spawned the first international human rights movement in this country. And by that, I mean it's the first time Americans came together to go overseas in body, in person, to give aid and bring relief to a people who were being murdered en masse thousands of miles away. And really, the first international human rights movement in this country begins with the Armenian massacres of the 1890s. It's Clara Barton who takes the Red Cross overseas for the first time in February of 1896. She spends most of that year with her Red Cross teams. She's in Constantinople, and the Red Cross teams are in the provinces rebuilding the Armenian economy. Americans spoke out in huge numbers. Elite Americans, intellectuals, reformers, political leaders, as well as the broad populace, a grassroots movement. Julia Ward Howe, Clara Barton, I mentioned, Stephen Crane, William and Henry James, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, Theodore Roosevelt, William Jennings Bryan, Ezra Pound, H.L. Mencken, and so on, are among the voices that speak out on the Armenian issue over the course of four decades. And Americans also give enormous amounts of money through an NGO. Well, many NGOs, really, starting in the 1890s, but the most famous was the foundation called Near East Relief, which in the end would give close to $110 million in aid for, as they were called, the starving Armenians. And if you tabulate that by today's currency, it comes to something like $1.3 billion. So we have this extraordinary outpouring from Americans, again, from Sunday schools and churches and synagogues, to major industrialists like John D. Rockefeller Jr. And Sr. as well, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegies, the Mellons, and so forth. So it galvanized a big piece of America for almost four decades, from the 1890s into the early 1920s.
Peter Balakian, I wonder if you could say if you think recognizing the Armenian genocide today still matters. Before you go into that, the other thing I wanted you to add was the double killing aspect that you addressed with regards to denial.
Well, as I say, you know, when any human rights crime goes unacknowledged by the perpetrator and unpunished, I think we have a grave kind of moral and ethical situation. The denial is a kind of ethical concept that scholars have developed over the recent decades, especially in the wake of Holocaust denial, and now even more dramatically in the wake of the denial of the Armenian genocide by the Turkish government. When you have denial, you have a very serious moral problem, and scholars in the genocide community continue to reiterate that the denial of genocide is the final stage of genocide because it seeks to demonize the victims and rehabilitate the perpetrators. And it sends the message that genocide doesn't matter. It demands no moral accountability. And, of course, it encourages, it paves the way for more genocide to come. I think Elie Wiesel has eloquently used the term double killing to talk about how denial kills the memory of the event as well. And Robert J. Lifton has noted that in the case of denial, a counterfeit reality is created that attempts to rob the survivor population and the legacy population of the victims of moral order. So I think the Turkish government is being asked to deal with its past in a moral way, and that the more it engages in extreme propaganda of denial and hysteria, I think the more it impedes its own progress as a country that's now seeking to join Europe and become part of a democratic society. But I think that genocide, the study of genocide first, is important, whether we study the Armenian case, the Jewish case, the Rwandan case, or the Cambodian case. We are studying genocide so we can learn how the worst can happen, how the ultimate human crime can happen, and what we might as citizens do to understand why these catastrophes happen and how we might work to prevent. I mean, obviously, the goal in studying genocide is also about prevention and about engaging us in action in the present. Anybody who cares about the Armenian genocide should be engaged in what's going on in Sudan in the Darfur region, should be engaged in the lessons of Rwanda and the Holocaust and Pol Pot's genocide in Cambodia. So that in the end, this is, of course, urgently about species preservation. It's about the ultimate issues of our survival as a human race. And the Armenian case has a lot to teach us. And as I've just noted, it has a lot to teach us about the importance of justice. A genocide denied by an unrepentant government, as the Turkish government is today, creates a grave moral problem and a demon that won't go away, for not only for the perpetrator and the victim culture, but really for the world.
Peter Balakian, thank you so much for joining us. Peter Balakian is a professor of humanities at Colgate University and the author of Black Dog of Fate and also The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide in America's Response. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Ben Bagdikian was born just before the second part of the Armenian Genocide. He was an infant when his family escaped. Ben Bagdikian is the former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley and is one of the foremost American journalists and media critics. Ben Bagdikian has won many of the highest journalism awards and has authored 6 books, including In the Midst of Plenty, The Poor in America, The Information Machines, The Effet Conspiracy and Other Crimes by the Press, Double Vision, Reflections on My Heritage, Life and Profession, and The Media Monopoly. Listeners are familiar with much of Ben Bagdikian's work, but what some are not as familiar with are his family history and its impact on his work. Welcome to the show, Ben Bagdikian.
I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. In your memoirs, Double Vision, you describe your family's exodus from Armenia during the time of the Armenian Genocide. Can you tell that story to our listeners?
I was born in Turkey during the last of the massacres of Armenians by the Turks, and we were forced to flee when I was 11 days old over frozen mountains, and we were lucky that we all survived, though a few years later, as a result, my mother died. But at that time, this was after the main genocide of 1915-1916, as we left, my older sisters, I had 4 older sisters who were old enough to remember, who saw Armenian churches into which most of the Armenians had been forced in, and the churches had been set on fire. So they're just within Marash. During that week, 5,000 Armenians were killed by the Turks. And that's just one incident, one day, 1 week, in the fading days of the genocide.
So how did your family manage to survive and then manage to escape?
Well, because my father was an extraordinary man. He had been a professor at an American college in Tarsus, Turkey. And he was asked after World War I to organize the educational system in that area. And so he had some standing in the community. And we were able to salvage a horse, my mother's horse, his name was Mozart. And by his incredible efforts of keeping the family going, while thousands, according to the French record, which I have looked at in Paris, of the retreating French troops and of the retreating Armenians froze to death, my father's efforts kept us going, kept us alive, built fires during the night somehow, and we escaped with the last of the retreating French troops miles away from the railroad center to the south of the city where I was born.
So your family was under French protection, and that was part of why you survived.
Yes, we were lucky. We were, and most of my relatives, Armenian relatives, had members of their family who froze to death on that march or who were killed by the Turks directly. And the remaining Armenians in the city who could not get away, as I say, 5,000 of those were killed by the Turks. And that is a very small number in the fading days of the genocide.
This was what year, roughly?
This was the 1920.
And how long did it take for your family to escape?
It took 5 days to go over the mountains with deep snow, sub-freezing weather. My wife and I researched the records, military records in France, and their troops suffered hundreds of losses through freezing and through Turkish troops firing on the fleeing people.
Now, you went back to your family's old village years later. What was your experience?
I wanted to see the city where I was born, where I'd left when I was 11 days old. And I found, in the beginning, a modern city with double-barrel streets with pretty flowers in the median, and then went on to what was an abandoned older city where very large buildings were still intact, which was the American Congregationalist High School built by American Congregationalist missionaries, and college, where both my parents were educated. My father later got his graduate degree in American University. And that older part of the city, except for those two buildings, which were padlocked, was in rubble, the site where our family would have lived and where the hospital I was born was just rubble, had been all been destroyed. And I had also been there earlier as a foreign correspondent and went to Turkey. I think individual Turks, in our own experience, according to my family, during the fleeing in the last days of the genocide, had been friends, and a few were willing to hide people, but most, of course, were under orders of the leaders of the genocide to kill the Armenians. And they were, of course, in World War I, allies of Germany. Turkey was an ally of Germany against Russia, Great Britain, France, and the United States. So we were very fortunate. And most of the relatives we have now, or did have in my childhood, had members of their family who were not so lucky.
Do you think that your heritage and your family's history has impacted your journalism?
Well, I think subconsciously it did lead me to that. But certainly as a journalist, I was always very sensitive to observe directly a phenomenon that was going on with my own ears and eyes, reported accurately, without prejudice, so that there would be a record. And it made me sensitive, I think, to people who had their own problems in life. And I spent a great deal of time with such people. I did a book on the poor in America. In many ways, I think, either subconsciously and then later consciously, I saw the need for precise, accurate reporting with sufficiently sound background in which some phenomenon was happening. I did not depend on official communiques, which are usually partially untrue, but on what I could discover on my own, talking to frontline troops and being present at events. I covered the misfortunes of people and being sensitive to it, but also as I covered government, because as I.F. Stone once said, every journalist should understand one thing: all governments lie sometime. But every government, every public official puts himself and herself in the best light. Whether that was influenced by my family history, I don't know. It certainly was subconsciously part of that. I also spent a great deal of time dealing with the outcasts of the society, the poor. I did stories about prisons and the necessity of not being swayed by official reports or cynical about what people tell you, because you check on them as much as you can. I have learned my own family history due to the accounts that became reliable of what others reported at the time.
Have you ever looked at how the media handled the Armenian Genocide?
What has happened for many, many years is that Turkey, up to the present time, has denied that there was an organized program to kill Armenians. All the documentary evidence is otherwise. Lord Bryce of England had a very famous book in which he used eyewitnesses all over the Armenian-occupied places of Turkey for eyewitnesses' account. The ambassador, U.S. ambassador at the time to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau, wrote in his cables back to the United States what was happening to the Armenians. He cites one instance which is in the archives of the State Department, when one of the two leaders of the genocide, Enver Pasha, called him in and said, "Ambassador, we have now got rid of the Armenians. Many of them had insurance policies with American insurance companies, and I demand those policies because these Armenians were Turkish subjects." And in his book and in the archives of the cables to the State Department, Ambassador Morgenthau says, "I will do no such thing." But it is in the cables. It's in the archives of the United States, in the archives of Germany, the archives of Britain, the archives of France, so that the documentary history is unmistakable, but yet Turkey continues to deny that it happened. And the media, for a very long time, certainly up until about 5 or 10 years ago, referred to the alleged genocide of the Armenians, because each time they did what is one of the problems in journalism. Journalism should always listen to both sides, but in a he said, she said argument, it is not usually true that one side is all right and the other side is all wrong. So every time there would be a memorial for the Armenian genocide, the newspapers would then go to the local Turkish embassy or consulate, and the Turkish representative would say, "No such thing happened." Therefore, the newspapers would refer to the alleged genocide. I think they no longer do that. It is now so clear. The documentary evidence and studies are so overwhelming that I think there are very few papers of any reputation that refer it now to an allegation.
Thank you very much for joining us.
How many boys were in that pile, do you know?
Well, I would say there was about 8 or 10. And here's, you see this?
Scar right here on your face?
Yeah. They got me right there.
With a sword?
With a sword or bayonet. And I was in a pile of kids, you know. I couldn't cry. If I did, I wouldn't be here today.
It's because they thought you were dead.
They thought I was dead, yeah. So in the evening, the mothers and grandmothers, aunts, they went and picked up their kid that weren't dead yet. And those that were dead, they pushed into the river, Euphrates River, to go down. Others over there, with their hands, dug a grave in the sand on the shore and buried them.
That was the voice of Sam Kadorian, who escaped the genocide as a little boy. When we come back, can political campaigns ever succeed in China? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why have so many human rights campaigns, such as Free Tibet and the Falun Gong, failed in China? Why have others? Better environmental protection? HIV/AIDS care fared better. What have the costs been on political movements with the more successful campaigns? Stephen Noakes joins us. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland and the author of The Advocacy Trap, Transnational Activism and State Power in China. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Stephen Noakes. It's great to have you here talking about your new book, The Advocacy Trap. Perhaps the title is the place to start. Why is it a trap?
Well, I call it The Advocacy Trap because most of the international actors, NGOs, foundations, and so forth that initially flowed into China thought that they were going to change China from the outside in. And what has happened more often than not, actually, is that the reverse is true. They themselves wound up in a position where their mission and message was actually shaped through their engagement with China's government.
The way you approached the book is you sort of contextualized it within this context of international NGOs and human rights groups that other scholars have studied about how they do manage to change things through this interconnectedness. You sort of debunked that that works all the time.
Engagement was supposed to be an alternative to isolation. Isolation had not worked. For example, the United States had attempted to do this with Cuba, an embargo that was supposed to bring the Castro regime to its knees, and then 50 years later was still in place and simply had to be abandoned for lack of desired effect. Engagement, on the other hand, was supposed to be about bringing non-democratic regimes like China into the global conversation. Let's make them play by the same global trading rules as everyone else. Who knows, maybe we can socialize these countries to liberal values in one way or another. Seems that that's not the case either.
Now, the previous scholars who had looked at NGO advocacy, what do you think it was that they missed?
There was a time when NGOs in the study of international politics were supposed to be the tip of the spear at a time when states, governments, as traditionally defined, were in decline. This is the immediate post-Cold War era, and scholars were writing very openly about the declining relevance of states, about the obsolescence of states in both real and conceptual terms. What was replacing those states and that international system of states was a global civil society, they said. This was what globalization was about, a borderless world. It turns out borders and states actually matter quite a bit. I, of course, have the benefit of hindsight. It's been 25, 30 years now since a lot of these writings came out, but governments matter an enormous amount. State policies matter an enormous amount for the crafting of the mission and message of advocacy networks and NGOs.
So the idea of it just being civil society mattering and being interconnected, I mean, it seems like states matter, but economic connections matter more.
They may do. And there are elements of economics at play in all of the groups that I've studied for this book, each of the six different advocacy networks. Other things may matter just as much. For example, personal connections. Knowing someone on the inside is often three-quarters of the battle. But we can't sit here and pretend that material interests aren't at play, even in those groups which might not necessarily advertise that that's how they work.
So I suppose somebody could say that what you're guilty of is something that you actually said in the book. You said we have to now look at the unromantic and often uncomfortable realities. Maybe you're guilty of saying to the optimists, let's get real.
I think that's right in some sense. I see the book as a bit of a bucket of cold water on that excessively rosy picture of transnational civil society, of global civil society that we had back in the mid to late 90s. When I say uncomfortable and unromantic, what I'm really asking that community of practitioners is, how willing are you to get your hands dirty? Just how dirty? What would you sacrifice to get just an inch of what you want actually done?
You talked about some of the changes that these organizations that maybe wanted to be pure but had to sort of shift. You know, you said it was kind of like mission creep, but it was a
sort of a compromised position they had to go into even to see an ounce of change.
I call it advocacy drift. The allusion to mission creep works, but only up to a certain point. Mission creep is actually about the administrative bloat, that fattening up of institutions that happens through bureaucratization over time. Advocacy drift can be actually just the opposite. What it refers to is a scaling back, in some instances, a complete reversal of the principled core that actually defines an international NGO or movement. So, for example, one of the examples I talk about in the book is the Tibetan independence movement. For 60 years, it was driven and bound by this commitment to the idea that there ought to be a free and independent Tibet. That is no longer the core idea, the core mission. What exactly happened here? Well, I think it was 60 years of banging one's head against the wall. It was very clear that China's government was never in a million years going to go for that. So there had to be this strategic tailoring of the central objective in a manner that was palatable to those who actually comprised that movement.
And so if you were going to describe what that achieved, what would you say that is?
In that particular case, I don't think it's clear yet. I do couch that at the end of the book and say I don't think the story is finished. Normally what I would say, at least in the context of the Tibetan independence movement, is that with the head cut off, the body will die. And so what will happen as one Dalai Lama passes away and another takes his place? What will that mean for the coherence of the movement? If I was to make a prediction, I would say the movement as we now know it is not likely to be in a few years' time.
And that's largely because China's government just refused to play in the ways that they wanted them to.
That's right. I mean, it's almost never the case that foreign activists succeed in convincing China to change its mind, to change its policies on a given issue. It's incredibly rare that China's government adopts a position for reasons other than something it didn't already favor anyway for its own purposes. And so that can actually create a great deal of confusion when we actually attribute certain effects to advocacy networks. It can look like they are having some kind of meaningful impact when in reality, it's just a coincidence.
How would you compare the Tibetan case with, say, the Falun Gong case?
Well, they both fall under what I would generally term human rights, and both have achieved exactly nothing, no aspect of their original mission and message. What actually differentiates the one from the other is that the Falun Gong case does not exemplify advocacy drift. It has shown much greater commitment to its core principle, despite the fact that it really doesn't have any credible hope of succeeding. I don't think that necessarily means that Falun Gong practitioners are more ideologically pure. And the goal of the book isn't to criticize the sincerity of everyone's convictions. But what I do say is that their incentives may be different. When there's nothing but the fall left, how one takes the fall might matter a great deal. And I think that that's exactly what Falun Gong practitioners are thinking when they remain committed to this objective when the odds are so strongly stacked against them. The same might not be true for the Free Tibet movement.
If we were to look at the campaigns that did succeed, and you listed some of them in your book, they were quite different. Their mission was different. Their approach was different. What were those?
The first and most obviously successful instance was the campaign to improve China's intellectual property rights regime for exactly the reason you might think of. It has everything to do with keeping China attractive as a place to invest by convincing foreign investors that their proprietary technology is going to be safe and not ripped off, and that brand integrity actually means something. The Chinese government actually does itself a solid. It gets to continue to improve the lot of the middle class, general growth in the country's wealth and its redistribution as well. There are other more successful examples. The one that comes immediately to mind is the Greenpeace campaign, which was initially aimed at getting China to adopt a cap and trade, a firm cap on its carbon emissions. It exemplified advocacy drift in the sense that China rejected that cap and trade scheme, believing probably pretty accurately that it would be bad for growth. It actually was worth it in the context of this Greenpeace campaign to amend the central goal. What they actually said was, maybe it doesn't matter so much how China's carbon outputs are reduced, as long as they get reduced. And so they and others within this transnational campaign took to partnering more actively with state agencies and government actors in order to see that new targets were set.
Do you think that in some cases it's not quite drift as much as it's strategic overshooting? And with the idea that, yes, we'll compromise at some point?
That might be true. I can't actually think of a concrete example where I know that a sort of false target, a high bar was set, knowing very well it was unachievable, but so that any impact that came in below that bar seemed phenomenal nevertheless, given the impossible-looking odds. What I say in the book is that I think there's something at the core of these advocacy networks where these groups can face a real conflict of interest. At what point does pragmatism actually undermine principle? I don't know that there's a clear or consistent answer to that question, but what I wanted to do here is call attention to that issue, which the international relations and political science literature I'm addressing has really not done a great job of.
So you would think that in the case of the environment and in the case of the intellectual property, where China did change, did address the goal of the advocacy group, but they did it really more for their own advantage?
That's
right.
Would
you say that's right?
Yeah. What I develop in the latter chapters is what I call a domestic legitimacy-based explanation. Legitimacy simply means the right to rule. How does this government retain its moral authority? How does it retain the consent of those it governs over? And when you look at this question of the impact of advocacy networks through this prism of legitimacy, the decisions that the Chinese government makes actually make a lot more sense. It can, for example, ignore the claims of Falun Gong practitioners and Free Tibet activists because those things are largely not important for its domestic legitimacy. On the other hand, it has to address issues that affect economic productivity or the cleanliness of the air, its fitness to be breathed by people. Those are the kinds of issues that, if not properly addressed, will affect the Chinese Communist Party's legitimacy and its ability to govern.
So it's really largely about power and maintaining power.
That's exactly it. It's a study in authoritarian resilience.
Mm. There were two other cases that come to mind. One was dealing with AIDS and HIV treatment, and the other was about trying to abolish the death penalty. What happened in those cases?
I refer to these jointly as instances of intercessory advocacy. In the HIV/AIDS case, it was scholars and scientists and medical experts who were actually shrewd enough to recognize a moment when it presented itself, to see an opportunity to influence the about-face that China was itself making. For many years, China's response to the HIV/AIDS crisis, which was clustered in the southwest of the country, was ideologically driven. The sense was that because this was a disease of intravenous drug users and sex workers, they got what they deserved. These were depraved people who deserved to die. There were other much more pointed statements that the Chinese leadership made in the early 1980s that HIV/AIDS was symptomatic of sick capitalist societies. It wasn't until quite a while later when the disease actually threatened to undermine the party's own legitimacy in action in addressing a public health crisis, for example, that there came a moment when UN scientists and sympathetic others from around the world were able to say, you know what, we think we could present information to China's government in such a way that they will find palatable. They spoke the value-neutral, ostensibly value-neutral language of science and said, here's our data. Here's what we think you can do to address this problem. And that, for China's government, was a win-win. They got to address the concerns of the Chinese public and show themselves to be accountable, responsible, able to deal with emerging health crises. The case of the death penalty abolition campaign is somewhat different. This is one of those instances where attributing a causal effect to the international campaign is, I believe, a mistake. There have been vast reductions in the numbers of the executed in China in recent times. We are not in a position to say exactly what those numbers are, because technically the number of death sentences carried out each year remains a state secret. However, the best available information, which comes from Amnesty International, says that it's roughly half what it was a decade ago. One might be tempted, therefore, to assume that international pressure, international scrutiny, has had something to do with it. It's actually not the case at all. Beginning in 2007, a new policy was introduced, known in English as kill fewer, kill carefully. The idea was to retain the death penalty for the most serious offenders while actually making it more institutionalized, more juridical. In this way, China's Communist Party got to appear both tough on crime when circumstances warranted and increasingly law-bound. It was about demonstrating a commitment to stability and order, but also a commitment to the rule of law. These are announced and well-known priorities for China's Communist Party. So again, it scores a victory, but it's not clear that international activists really had anything to do with it at all.
So it seems like one of the arguments in your book is that there can be, if framed properly and if focused properly, changes in particular policies in an incremental way in a country like China, an authoritarian country, but don't expect anything major.
That's right. I mean, it's really about redrawing what we mean by success, reconceptualizing success, and understanding that in the extremely unlikely situation that an international group succeeds in getting China to change its mind, these are really baby steps that are being taken. You cannot expect major changes overnight. And if those changes were to occur, it's probably not because of something an NGO did.
One of the journalists I interviewed before for a book was using the sentence of "those with the guns make the laws." And it sounds like what you're saying is those with the power will say yes or no, and they don't really, it doesn't matter what the rest of us say.
That's mostly true. You know, that original framing of powerful transnational civil societies versus increasingly inconsequential obsolete states, I don't think that there's necessarily a ton of truth to that. That original puzzle in the research was presented as one of the soft power of advocacy networks triumphing over the hard power of states. Why should that be? After all, states have tanks and armies and guns, whereas international advocates have to make do with beauty and truth. Well, the tanks, the guns, the armies, the hard power actually does prevail most of the time.
Yeah, so you don't see an Arab revolution happening in China?
No, I do not. Were it to occur, it would be unrelated to international pressure.
And so in the end, you're saying, well, maybe we have to think through what is achievable. You said good governance, for example, but is that really the enemy of, say, human rights and democracy? Or is it just, look, we can get this done, maybe we should?
When I mention good governance, no, it's not necessarily the enemy of human rights and democracy. I mean, in this part of the world, out there, we know democracy and good governance to be two sides of the same coin. I just mean that China is taking baby steps. It is a better governed country, substantially better governed than it was 40 years ago, for example. It's just extremely unlikely that outsiders, foreigners somehow, are going to be able to promote larger changes. Those sorts of
things
have to come
from within. Unless there's an economic reason for it.
It's substantially more likely to come from within because of this focus that the party has, some might say obsession with domestic legitimacy. The loss of that will mean big things for the Communist Party and the ability of the regime to survive. But at the moment, the best available information tells us that the Communist Party actually enjoys rather high popular legitimacy. There is not the widespread opposition to its rule that so many imagine that there is. And this means that certain things like Falun Gong and the Free Tibet movement actually are not terribly important and can just be shunted aside with no political cost. Other things, that's not necessarily true of. There would be a reckoning for a party that did not take responsibility for a major public health crisis or failed to deliver a public good like drinkable water, clean air, something like that.
You mentioned that sometimes they use the frame, for example, in the AIDS crisis of, oh, this is just, you know, ugly, dirty capitalism rearing its ugly head. But isn't China, in fact, a capitalist country?
That rhetoric is very old now. They tend not to talk like that anymore. But it was incredibly common back in the mid-70s. The China's new
until
rulers.
They became capitalists.
That's
themselves.
Right. It was really not until after 76 when the second generation of leadership came to power and there was a more market-oriented model of socialism for China. The term socialism with Chinese characteristics covers all sins, right? I think it's fancy talk for reinventing the rules, making them up as we go along. The official slogan given to this is crossing the river by feeling the stones.
Mm.
Practice is the sole criterion for determining truth. It means we're making it up as we go along. But you can't simply back away from all that old-time socialist rhetoric. It would mean telling a country of 1.3 billion people that they had been lied to. What you have to do is tweak what Chinese socialism actually means. Continue to reinvent the party's own mission and message in accordance with social expectations and demands. That is how China's Communist Party can actually survive when so many other strong communist states didn't 25, 30 years ago.
Well, part of that is that it's not really communist.
It helps that people are able to afford a little more.
So they use the term Communist Party, but it's not communist really at all.
It looks different to us from the outside.
It certainly wasn't the communism that Marx talked about.
It's incredibly different from that. It's not an old-time Leninist state. But equally, some of those old-time institutions have not faded away nearly as quickly as you might have thought. There are distinct socialist mentalities that remain, one of which is an intense distrust for civil society actors, whether those are domestic or foreign. You would think that along with market reforms and opening up, that there would be greater space for transnational civil society, for domestic civil society. It's not true. If anything, it's gotten much tighter. And China comes by this stance quite honestly, given its origins of Leninist stock and its not so great interactions with foreigners in recent history.
And when you talk about this tweaking that it's been doing, is that how you would contextualize the most recent governance advances of expanding the presidency into additional terms? Is that just tweaking or is that something else?
I think that's a little bigger now. I understood the recent proposed constitutional changes as mostly an undoing of the informal mechanisms that the second, third, and fourth generations of party leadership had put in place. It seemed since the late 1980s that what was emerging in China was a groupthink model, a form of collegial rule in which certain informal institutions mattered a great deal and were important for ensuring the survival of the party at moments of political transition and leadership succession. So one of these was mandatory retirement. Another was a formal cap on the term limits of the presidency. Now it seems that these things are actually not as important when you can have one leader with a great deal of power concentrated around them simply move those principles to the side when it suits them.
And so ultimately, what do you think it will mean for China and for the rest of us?
I don't think you're likely to see big changes in China for quite some time. And when I say big changes, I mean regime change. It's probably time to stop talking about a liberal democratic China. I'd only add parenthetically that China considers itself a paragon democracy. In fact, the Chinese indigenous understanding is that it is a more genuine democracy than is the United States. Why? Because instead of having someone sit down and write the Constitution and create institutions that then shape and guide the behavior of ordinary citizens, the Chinese system is one that attempts to build the institutions out of the culture, right? In that sense, the domestic argument in China is that it's actually more authentically democratic because it's more attuned to what people actually want.
So the final thing in terms of China in the world that I just wanted to ask you about that is less tuned into the advocacy trap, but more just as you as a China scholar, is the move to militarize some of the islands in the South Pacific. What do you think that has in store?
You asked me a moment ago about the impact for the rest of us. It certainly matters a great deal to New Zealand because it retains a certain caretaker role in conducting the foreign and any military affairs associated with these island countries. The most recent example of the thing you're talking about was the report that came out yesterday that China had been in discussions with Vanuatu over some sort of permanent military installation there. I think it just means that the balance of power in the region is slowly but palpably shifting, and that there is now an emerging tug of war between traditional aid powers, traditional superpowers, by which I mean the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, and so forth, and newcomers like China. Were I in a position to be speaking to Jacinda Ardern here and now, I think I would say, pay attention, Madam Prime Minister, to the message of the advocacy trap. Ask yourself those hard questions. Exactly what are your principles? How committed to them are you? How dirty are you willing to get your hands? Would you walk away from some of the trade commitments that New Zealand has made? Would you keep those commitments by shutting up when it's in the interest of shutting up?
Tough question.
Yeah, it's really about searching one's soul, because it's almost surely not the case that by bringing China closer to Pacific Island societies, that China is going to be the one that's changed.
Well, Stephen Noakes, the book is called The Advocacy Trap, senior lecturer at the University of Auckland. It's a great pleasure to host you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster,
Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin,
Anais Amin,
Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.